This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What's the first thing you think of when you hear the word home? A boxy house with a grassy lawn? Maybe it's a flag of your home country or the face of a friend or loved one. For many in Africa and its diaspora, the meaning of the word home has been changed and disrupted by external forces for centuries. War, globalization, gentrification, and the changing environment all affect what home means and who's in control of what happens there. A festival and conference at UNC Chapel Hill this week brings together scholars and artists from across the globe to explore the meaning of home for women in Africa and its diaspora. I'm joined first by conference co-director Tanya Shields, who is a professor of women's and gender studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Tanya. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Tell me more about how the idea of this conference came about.
It came about because Kathy Perkins, my co-director, read Heather Williams's book, Help Me to Find My People. And Help Me to Find My People is a book about the African-American quest to find family after the end of the Civil War. And Kathy read this book and she was very excited. And she said, we have to do something about this. And I said, okay. And she said this and I kept saying, okay. And then she came to me one day and she's like, I've started fundraising. So we were in business and that was in 2014.
How did all of this then coalesce around the idea of home?
A critical part of Heather's book, we felt, is that when you're trying to reunify with your family, that is a sense of home that you're trying, particularly for enslaved people who were separated at a whim, that looking for that connection, that belonging, that rootedness was about home. And so we felt that home was a way that people could enter into this discussion, that it is both a simple and complex question, that we all have homes, or we have, even if we don't have home, we have an ideal of home. We have an image of what home should be or should be like, even if our homes are problematic or places we can't stay. So we thought that that was a lens and an opportunity that can invite a lot of people in.
You used that phrase, on a whim, and I think it calls to mind for those of us who've never questioned what home is and for whom home has always been a stable vision, the tenuousness of home for
Absolutely.
People whose position and whose place is contingent.
Yes. And I mean, recently in our state, given the recent bill, HB2, I mean, we see that contingency in action. We see that trans people, gay people have been criminalized and their homes have been made absolutely contingent, absolutely tenuous with that bill. So we see how that is happening right now. You know, Heather's book is about newly freed people in the 19th century, but we see right now in the 21st century how that happens.
And the idea of bringing artists together of all kinds, what role does art play in all of this?
Oh, art is central. We feel that art is the source material, and it's really an opportunity. Art gives us an opportunity and, again, a way in. My own work is I look at cultural production in the Caribbean and how cultural production can help us understand another person's story. And so we feel that whereas you might dismiss something in the newspaper and you say, oh, that person's so biased or that person's so this, if you open yourself up to a piece of art, whether it be film or poetry or dance or a novel, and you get into the world of those characters, then you have opened yourself up to something special and that you're ready to engage in a conversation.
I'm joined now by one of the visiting artists participating in the conference and festival. Yaba Bedu is a British and Ghanaian filmmaker. Yaba, welcome. Good to have you here.
Lovely to be here.
Tell us about this week. You're going to be sharing your documentary, Witches of Gambaga.
Yes.
Tell us the story.
Well, The Witches of Gambaga is a documentary I made with my co-producer, Amina Mama. And it's about the story of a group of women who are forced to live in exile from their families in northern Ghana at a witches camp at Gambaga, which has been going on for over 100 years. In northern Ghana, there are about 3,000 women who are accused of witchcraft, and just so that they will are able to live and aren't killed on the spot, they live in exile from their families until they're able to return again. And this was just a study of a group of women and why they were accused of witchcraft, what they feel about that, and how they managed to survive away from their families until they return.
So this really is a way to examine home, particularly in the context of people who have to form a new kind of home.
Yes. And it's a way of looking at scapegoating as well, which is happening a lot at the moment. How women are often the targets of, because of their sexuality, of a lot of ambivalent feelings within their communities. So if something suddenly goes wrong, what better than to blame a woman, preferably an older woman, who hasn't got people to protect her, and accuse them for being the cause of your plants dying, somebody dying suddenly, or you know, an accident that you've had.
Europeans and Americans and Africans have been persecuting witches for centuries. What was going on at the turn of the 19th century that caused the creation of this camp? That sounds like an interesting time period.
Well, I think at the end of the 19th century, that was when colonization was taking place in Ghana. And I think the country has been going through various upheavals since then, whether it's independence, which was positive, but then soon after that, you know, coups and then counter coups, and then the IMF comes into the country, sort of structural adjustment, which creates another convulsion. And what we forget is that the people at the end of all these different upheavals tend to be the poorest, and they're the ones that suffer most, and they're the ones who are desperately trying to make sense of, you know, why is it that they can barely earn enough to live? So whether it's the middle classes in America or the poor in Ghana, the changes that are happening in the world are having a real impact on human beings.
So the vulnerabilities of the anxieties that are felt in this turmoil and in this period of change, particularly as markets go global and local farmers find they're out of work, they have to blame somebody. And of course, the person who gets blamed, as you say, are the most vulnerable.
Exactly. And they get the old woman who lives at the end of the road.
But often successful women, so old perhaps, but in many cases, women too.
Are.
So the most vulnerable among the most successful among the most vulnerable, which
especially
is a
in
pattern.
Patriarchal societies where, like Northern Ghana is, where to be a woman on your own is to be extremely vulnerable. But I met several women. One of them was Azara, who had a lorry. She used to transport mangoes, transport wood and sell it. She had a cook shop. So she was very, very prosperous, but she headed her household on her own. And when there was an epidemic of meningitis in her neighborhood, the women who were accused of witchcraft and causing the epidemic were all women who were actually successful businesswomen and living on their own. And so they were targeted, just as successful women are often have a very hard time in male-dominated societies anywhere.
It has to be said that the correlation here in the United States, the Tulsa massacre and the Wilmington massacre, again, happened in communities of color where there was great business success. And it was precisely those vulnerable and yet successful communities that were targeted for the violence. So and it resonates again today as we see the violence inherent in our national political discourse, the violence in our primary campaign, again reflecting these anxieties.
Yes.
So it's timely. I'm joined now by another one of the visiting artists participating in the festival and conference, telling our stories of home. It's taking place this week and next at UNC Chapel Hill. Malika Ndlovu is a poet and a playwright from South Africa. Malika, welcome. Good to have you here.
Same. It's very good to be here.
So you're a poet, playwright, and performer. How do you bring those artistic approaches together to explore this question of home?
Well, maybe home is the starting point. The soil of how South Africa has been impacted historically by same forces, slavery, colonialism, and then our glorious historical moment of apartheid, which still is very much in existence, even though it's not legal. I think the fact that people have had to be resilient and resourceful means that I studied a range of things and had to learn A to Z how to get a project off the ground. So I studied performing arts project management, and I was always writing poetry, and I wanted to be an actress and had to direct when I was studying theater. So the convergence of those things was quite natural, and a way to also create some level of sustainability in my career, that I could put any of these hats on at a given time and get work.
And what about the importance of what Tanya said earlier, the idea that, and I'm going to put words in your mouth, Tanya, but that art links the heart and the mind in a way that engages us perhaps more fully than simple headlines and essays about these various topics.
That's absolutely my language you're speaking now. Obviously, for me, poetry isn't, words are half of what poetry is about and what art is about, actually, because dance is poetry. This conversation is quite poetic. Color, movement, all kinds of. So I see poetry everywhere. For me, everything is poetry. And that sounds maybe a little wafty for some people. But I'm also particularly an activist or artivist, an applied artist, in the sense that I really believe in the healing, reconciliatory, therapeutic aspect of the arts. And poetry is an essence of that for me. But I use whatever medium necessary to achieve whatever that goal is.
You're going to be performing a series of poems this Friday called Turning and Returning. Could you share one of those poems with us now?
Definitely. It's kind of a signature poem of my first anthology called Born in Africa, But, and it unpacks some of those complexities. Hi-ya! Born in Africa, but breastfed another mother tongue, put to sleep on foreign lullabies, taught to pray for a Jesus heaven when I die. Born in Africa, but into a cultivated designated patch, flung far from the indigenous tree, strategy for carving out my destiny. Born in Africa, but mixed, equaled inferior, rearrange your exterior, scorned for the secret exposed by my skin, enslaving beliefs this child was bathed in. Born in Africa, but I have died to the hiding, dividing, fearful deciding of who I am, who I should be. Born in Africa, but a self-made prisoner, I release captivity. I am free. Free to unfold the sacred map. None other will dictate my individual destiny. Born in Africa, but living before and beyond. Living before and beyond. A universe awakens in me.
That is South African poet and playwright Malika Ndlovu reading her poem, Born in Africa, But. She is one of the international visiting artists in town for the UNC Chapel Hill Festival and Conference, telling our stories of home. Beautiful poem, and the suggestion of an internal map, I think, and the ways in which freedom are expressed. You know, it's, and again, whose language we're speaking, right? The idea that nationalist leaders in Africa were trained in Europe at the metropole, right, and embrace the idea of the nation state. They would come back and take the European boundaries, and that would be our freedom. This is a complex question of home, isn't it? I mean, and I guess my ultimate question for you is, how do we've seen how the unarticulated anxieties of, say, a white middle class and working class play out in violence here in the United States. How do these internal maps play out? How do we see them played out in the face of maybe in a more oppressive social order? What's the evidence that there's hope for this kind of thing?
I want to say young people. I think that the trauma and the luggage that older generations bear makes it a lot harder to make those shifts and changes. It's not a blanket or absolutist statement. You know, I'm 44 and I feel as though I'm, you know, four when I'm with my grandson. So it's not holding those fixed frames. But I do think that there's a powerful dialogue that young people are ready to have. And I think part of it is a sense that their identity isn't confined to the place they're born from, that they have a global internet dimension to their identities, that empowerment doesn't need a government to say you can stay here or can't go there, that they don't have to be rich. They can do this on one of the cheapest cell phones. All of this is a way that is liberating that sense of I navigate my own life. I can have a friend in India and a friend in Dubai and, you know, somewhere in the States and in Kenya. And we can have a conversation about hip hop, or we can talk about activism around cleaning the water in our area. I love that. I want to be with them.
Well, yeah, but how do you see that playing out? Again, these parallel streams that we all have to sort of hold in tandem.
I think I'm more conflicted about it. I think the fact that it, let's say, bringing the conversation back to witchcraft and accusations of witchcraft, the fact that a film was made with help from the women's movement in Ghana, in Africa, and also Europe and America, means that now there is a film which every student at the University of Ghana watches, so that we can actually start a national debate about superstitious beliefs and traditions. And once you get a dialogue going, whether it's between old and young people or it's among young people, once you're talking to people, once people are talking together and talking civilly to each other, then there's hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Malika, one of your current projects is compiling an online archive of African poetry. Tell us a little bit about that.
So badilishapoetry.com, badilisha is a Kiswahili word, which is the point of exchange or intersection. And I consciously rebranded that. It initially was the Spear Poetry Outdoor Festival, which was a live event. We had a certain budget annually to make a poetry festival happen. And we were thinking about how that's not the most resourceful way to use these funds if you have to pay so much for a few people to come from around the world and stay for a few days. And only those who can afford a ticket, have a car, la, 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 could make it to the audience. So it became a cyber platform, which also gives it longevity. It becomes a growing archive of now 500 African voices, diaspora, pan-African. And you can download this onto your phone. You can go on the site and listen to recordings or shows, podcasts twice a week of poets across genre, generations, languages, with their own approved translations of their work or summaries of the work.
And you have audio files, so they're reading their own in many cases.
Exactly. And now we've even been able to afford to get a scout to go to the places where people would need to record on their phones or don't have access to the recording equipment. It's extremely exciting that technologies also collapse the hierarchy of who's in the hallowed halls of literature and who's on the ground making beats, you know, because they're all on one stage now. And they can learn from each other.
You can find links to that site at our website, stateofthings.org.
Wonderful.
And link to that at So, Tanya, what are your hopes for the broader outcomes of this? Because I know that part of the idea is to extend this beyond the conference along the lines that Malika was talking about.
Yes, I want to thank our sponsors. We've had many sponsors on campus. We also are the recipient of an NEH grant that allows us to go sort of beyond the university. And one of the things that was important in that grant is how can you cause a ripple effect? So there are a couple of ways in which we're causing a ripple effect. The first is because we've brought these folks from around the world here, we are going to document this. Most of them are going to be interviewed, so we have an archives that people can can find when they need to. The other thing is we're working with the African Diaspora Fellows Program, which is a collaboration between UNC and Duke to teach North Carolina teachers all across the state how to incorporate issues from Africa and its diaspora into their curriculum. And those teachers are going to be they're going to come to events on Friday and Saturday. And then they're going to come back for a seminar in the summer to think about how they can incorporate what they've learned and what they've seen into their classrooms to really have that broader ripple effect across our state. The other thing I would say that I hope is, as these women have talked about, is we hope for dialogue. We hope that you come even if you're afraid. you bring those fears and you challenge yourself, you open yourself, you open your heart in a way.
Tanya Shields is the co-director of the Festival and Conference Telling Our Stories of Home and a professor of women's and gender studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Tanya, thank you so much
thank
for coming.
You.
Yaba Beydou is a British and Ghanaian filmmaker who made the award-winning film The Witches of Gambaga. Thank you, Yaba.
Thank you, Frank.
And Malika Indalovu is a poet and a playwright from South Africa. She's going to be performing her work at the Stone Center Theater Friday night, 7:30. Thank you so much for being on
the program. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You can find out more information about the conference and all of the work of these women and the other conference attendees at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a play that depicts the life of African-American man in the Jim Crow South, In Abraham's Bosom. Coming up. Stay tuned.